Hey, Fantastic fans, it's a whole new year, which means it's a whole new opportunity to check out the amazing and iconic looks that you can only find on goldenageoftennis.com. My resolution at the start of this new year is to play a lot more tennis, and I've never felt better on court than in these timeless Sergio Tacchini, Fila, and LS signature looks. Head to www.goldenageoftennis.com to get same-day worldwide shipping and 10% off at checkout with promo code FANTASTIC. Bring vintage tennis back to the courts with goldenageoftennis.com.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
I mean, they always have a big mouth, they always talk a lot, so it happened before, it's gonna happen again.
If I were to describe today's guest as a legend and tennis icon, it almost wouldn't be enough to describe the impact she's had on not only women's tennis, but also the sporting world. Born to legendary tennis parents Jimmy and Colette Everett in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, she would first find competition amongst her siblings, all of whom would win national junior tournaments. But it would ultimately be our guest and her idolized two-handed backhand that would grace the pages of tennis history. At just 15 years old, she would shock the tennis world by defeating its best player at the time, Margaret Court, at an event in North Carolina. And from there, her career would never be the same. She'd soon become an instant celebrity as millions would clamor to play like her, dress like her, and be inspired by her as she'd shatter tennis record after record, many of which she still holds today. She'd win the first of 18 Grand Slam singles titles at the 1974 French Open, where she'd also win her first of three Grand Slam doubles titles. Her dominance at that event and on clay is still unmatched today, as she has the most French Open titles in the Open era. She also has the distinction of becoming the first player in the Open era to be ranked number one in the computer rankings, which was all but inevitable if you're adding 157 WTA singles titles to your trophy case. She would officially retire on court during a tearful 1989 U.S. Open send-off. But luckily for fans, she stayed close to the game, most recently as an ambassador with longtime friend and storied rival Martina Navratilova at the WTA Finals in Guadalajara. With a world-class tennis academy that bears her family name, her important contributions to Tennis Magazine, and the countless matches she's called as the lead analyst for ESPN's tennis coverage, not to mention her appearances in television and movies, and hosting an iconic episode of Saturday Night Live, she's a beloved figure in the sporting world, and I'm so excited to say this right now. Our guest today is the fantastic Chris Everett. Chris, welcome to Fantastic Tennis.
Thank you for having me. I should have done this years ago, but thank you for being patient.
I'm so grateful. Just so you know, saying Chris, welcome to Fantastic Tennis is just as exciting for me as it probably was for you when you said, so stick around, we'll be right back on Saturday Night Live. I mean, that's pretty iconic, right? It's a big deal. I even put cologne on for the Zoom call today, by the way. That's how excited I am.
that actually was, you know, outside of tennis, that was one of my biggest thrills. I mean, it was so much fun to spend a week with them and to start with absolutely nothing, looking at John Lovitz, and I didn't even know these people at all. And we're looking at each other like, okay, no words are on paper. And then, you know, 5 days later, we have a whole show. It was pretty incredible.
I live in New York City. I pass 30 Rock every day on the way to the office, and I see SNL billboards, and I think, wow, what would it feel like to host Saturday Night Live? And now you just said it. I mean, I can imagine. What did you feel like at 11:29 when it's like ready to go live?
You know, we worked so hard for the 5 days, and that Saturday we had a dress rehearsal at 1 o'clock. So we had to pretend like we were doing the show at 1 o'clock. That's almost like warming up before a match for 30 minutes. You know, you get out there and you're all warm and you're sweating and you're into it. So the momentum was there. And then it was like, oh, there's nothing different than doing it at 11:30, except maybe there's going to be a little audience there.
And yeah, they got you so comfortable you sang on national television. So that's how that went.
I sang, I cursed, I pulled a sink out of the wall and threw it down. I mean, there's so many things that I did that I was like, oh my God, what should I really be doing this? But it turned out fine.
It was amazing. Amazing.
Yep.
You got to travel to Guadalajara this year for the WTA Championships. So amazing. The crowds this year in Mexico looked electric. It looked so fun. I thought the WTA did such a good job putting that tournament on. What were your thoughts at this year's finals?
I loved it. I didn't know what to expect, you know, because they only had two months, I believe, to conjure up and build a WTA final. So I had no idea what to expect. And I was like ready to be defensive, like, well, but they didn't have much time. But I was so impressed with the crowds. There were full crowds, sellout crowds at night, during the day, three quarter crowds, because most of the people were working. But the people were so enthusiastic and so had so much spirit and had so much love for the game of tennis and really applauded all of the eight young women. And the tournament, to me, went on without a hitch. I don't know. I was very impressed. And it's interesting because of maybe what's happening in China now. If we don't go back to China, I think that Latin America is a great section of the world to tap into for tennis that hasn't really been tapped into. I mean, it's not only Mexico, but it's all the South American countries. And I just feel like, you know, more and more players are starting to play and it's becoming more popular and the money is there. And, you know, I think that's one area that, again, we haven't really explored.
100%. Absolutely. So what was better, the food, the tennis, or the tequila?
I hate tequila. I'm a limoncello kind of girl.
That's the quintessential Chris cocktail. Okay.
Or peach schnapps.
Oh, okay.
But these are now shots. We're talking. These aren't cocktails. Shots for me. So I don't like tequila. So the tennis, you know, I watched the singles and the doubles and all the women were cooperative and so giving and to the fans. And I thought maybe they'd be a little burned out, but they weren't. They were playing, you know, their best tennis.
You just mentioned China. I want to talk about something serious, and I wanted to commend you because you're one of the very first players on Twitter that publicly came out, and you shined a very bright light on the Peng Shuai tragedy that we've all been following, and you've continued to talk about it, and I think that's so important that we do. What's been your take on this unbelievable story, and what do you think the tennis community needs to do to keep this story in the media?
Well, first of all, I have to commend the WTA. They've really taken a leadership role in really human rights. Steve Simon has headed that and, you know, gone on to say that the WTA will pull out of any business venture, which means obviously tennis tournaments, if we don't have a thorough and transparent investigation without censorship. You know, I read what Peng Shuai said about the sexual assault, and I read that back when it happened, when she put it out there. And then all of a sudden, I think everybody kind of forgot about her. And all of a sudden, she wasn't present. She wasn't appearing anywhere. She kind of disappeared. And, you know, I thought to myself, uh-oh, you know, she's in China, and they are notorious for silencing anyone who challenges the government. And they always suppress protests and, you know, they have control over their people. Let's just put it that way. And with that patriarchal system. And, you know, I got worried. I really got worried. And then heard that Peng's Instagram got wiped off, you know, of the internet. And it was really alarming. And, you know, you just read about the past history of China and how, you know, what they do to people who criticize the government. And this was really a high profile government official that she was saying this about. And so I'm almost like, okay, unless she steps off a plane in a neutral country and talks to us, you know, I'm not convinced she's or her family are being blackmailed at this point.
Absolutely. There's talk that Craig Tilley should invite her to the Australian Open and present the winner's trophy just to know that she's physically okay. I mean, obviously, we know she's not mentally okay at this point, but, you know, at least let's see her. So,
yeah, well, I mean, that'll be interesting. That's, you know, next month, the Australian Open, and that will be telling.
Yeah, well, let's keep hashtagging. So, all right, Chris, well, there's so much to talk about today. When everyone found out that you were coming on the show, we received hundreds of questions from Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Even my mom, Chris. And she doesn't even like tennis that much. I mean, so thanks.
Oh, that's so funny.
So I got brownie points. I appreciate that. So in honor of you being here, I'd like to play 15 Love. But in this version, I've compiled the most popular topics that your fans want answers to. Well, there was a whole bunch that I can't ask you on camera later. Maybe the memoir will cover most of these questions. We'll talk about that later. People are nosy, Chris. There are a lot of nosy people in the world for you.
So nosy.
The topics today range from the beginning of your career all the way to your life today. And for everyone listening, hit pause right now. Go grab your favorite Chris Evert inspired LS outfit, or maybe you have a Ted Tingling dress at home. Go put it on. Come back because we're about to get into the career and life of Christine Marie Evert. Let's start with topic one today, Chris, and it's your start in tennis. I always love to ask this first question because I mean, it's so interesting, but knowing the type of tennis family you were raised in, it's even more interesting. What was the first tennis match you remember watching live or on television?
You know, for some reason, Nancy Ritchie comes to mind. I don't know if it was Nancy playing Margaret or Nancy playing Billie Jean, but it was either Wimbledon or the US Open, black and white TV, you know, kind of fuzzy. And it just seemed like three planets away from reality for me. It's like, I never even thought, oh, that could be me one day. You know, I just never even thought. And I don't remember how old I was, but I remember watching them and just thinking that it just seemed so far off. The dream was, you know, I didn't know if it was ever going to come true or whatever. But, you know, a lot of kids now, they're like, even at 6, 7, 8 years old, they're like, oh, I want to be a pro. You know, like,
yeah.
I was just engulfed in the juniors. I mean, I was just, you know, trying to win 10 and unders and 12 and unders. And I never even thought about the pros really until probably, well, I shouldn't say, I definitely thought about it at 13 years old when I played in a tournament that my dad had called the Austin Smith. And I played Marion Eisel. So funny. Ironically, she's the one I beat my first US Open.
Yeah,
down,
absolutely.
Six match points.
Yeah.
Poor Marianne. Anyway, I was 13 and I played her. And I remember the score was three sets. It was like 6-1, 1-6, 6-1. But I remember, and I lost. But I remember thinking to myself at 13, wow, there's not that big a gap between myself and a number. I think she was 4 in the world at that time. Now, mind you, that wouldn't happen now because there's so much more depth. And those days, there wasn't the depth. But I just remember that was the first time I thought that it could be a possibility that I turned pro.
Okay, good. 13. Because, you know, we've seen it with Jennifer and Hingis and Venus and Serena. And they were destined at an early age to be number one.
Yeah.
And they had that confidence always. So a lot of fans asked, at what point did Chris say, I'm going to be number one? There we go. 13. That's how it worked. What was it like growing up in the Everett house, Chris? I think a lot of people assume that it was tennis around the clock for you.
Pretty much. It was, I didn't have any choice. Let's put it that way. I had a pretty strict father who you couldn't answer back to him. I mean, like you didn't really couldn't have a different opinion. And that was that generation of parents, you know, the ones that grew up in the 30s, 40s, 50s. So my dad was a player himself. And he won, I think, the U.S. indoors. He won the Canadian Open, played number one for Notre Dame. And then he went into the Navy. And when he came back, he had earned a living. So he settled in Fort Lauderdale and was a teaching pro. And there are five kids in our family. And he taught every single one of them, starting at 5 years old. And I remember I was going to kindergarten at 5 years old. And I was going after school. I would have play dates with my best friend, Kara Bennett. Still remember her name. And we go over to her house and she had a pool, which is like having a yacht now.
For sure.
You know, it's like you didn't have a pool back then. And so I got to go swimming and then we'd have barbecue hamburgers or barbecue chicken or whatever afterwards. She had a grill and I'm like, oh, I'm in heaven. All of a sudden, my dad started picking me up at school and bringing me to Holiday Park tennis courts. And I was really mad. But I suppressed it, of course, because I didn't want to get, you know, who knows what I would have gotten, spanked probably. So I remember just being really upset and really mad that he took me away from my best friend, but I developed friendships over there and he brought all the kids over when they were like 5 or 6 years old. And like you said, they all won national titles. Jeannie and I turned pro and were ranked, you know, in the world. And my other three siblings played number one for their colleges on tennis. So my dad never had to pay a cent for college. I think he was probably happier about that than the fact that I played number one, actually.
Your father is such an important part of tennis history. And he was a legendary coach, a big fan of yours in Palm Bay, Florida. Virginia Hewitt, she writes, Chris, your father was a tennis genius. Is there a piece of coaching or even just plain advice that he gave you that you still use and pass on today?
Well, two things. First of all, physically, as far as tennis is concerned, he was big on footwork. And, you know, nowadays I feel the emphasis is more on the grips, the follow through, the acceleration, power. But I think that my dad was mainly from the bottom up. You have to get into position before you can go for the big shot. So he was very much about footwork. And then mentally, I think he saw me get really upset when I was younger on the court. And I remember he came over to me and he said, don't let your opponent see that you're upset because they'll use that to their advantage. And they'll say, aha, I've got her. And he goes, just be cool. Don't let them see that you're upset. you know, don't let them see that you're winning or losing. Just kind of keep it in. And, you know, that might not work for some people, but it worked for me.
It did. Yeah, no, we're going to talk about the mental ferocity that you possessed in your career. With the help of your father, Chris, you'd soon become an unstoppable tennis prodigy, winning almost every junior match you'd play. You'd play your first senior level matches in 1969 with success, but it was an invitational tournament in North Carolina in 1970 that would have everyone start saying, I think we may have our next great champion on our hands, as you defeat the best player in the world at the time, Margaret Court, in straight sets. The same year she swept all four majors.
Yeah.
Do you remember that moment at all? I read such a sweet article that said that you had called home to your parents and they like had to clarify the score. Like, are you sure you got that right?
Yeah. Well, the biggest thrill was going up there because I went without my parents. It was like the first time I ever traveled without my parents. I went with my best friend, Lori Fleming, at the time. And Lori...
Did Lori have a pool or no?
No.
No. Ugh, Lori, come on. That's true friendship.
Lori was all tennis like me. And she was like, she was really good. And she, as a junior, was asked to play in the tournament and get a wild card. And so we went up and she lost to Virginia Wade, but it was like 6-4, 6-4. It was a really respectable score. And that's when I played Françoise Dürr, and I beat Françoise Dürr like 6-love, 6-1. And I remember she said after a press conference that her grandmother could have beaten her. So that was lovely. And then I played Margaret Court, and you're right, she had won the Grand Slam. And I won 7-6, 7-6. That was when the tiebreak was first 1-5. So it was, I think, 4-all in one of the tie breaks. And I think she served volley and I passed her. But it was on clay, which was my best surface. And, you know, back then, 3 out of 4 of the Grand Slams were on grass. So women and men both, they were all serving and volleying. I mean, they only needed ground strokes at the French Open. So I felt like, you know, I was one of the new type of players that was a baseliner. And I could just rally and place the ball. I didn't have a lot of power, but I could maneuver my opponent around. I could place the ball. I could drop shot, and I never missed. So I think that frustrated the women. And when they came into the net, I had enough time because it was on clay to pass them.
Yeah.
So anyway, I have to say her winning the 4 Grand Slams, I think her year had been done after the US Open. And this tournament, I have to say, was after the US Open. And she was tired. She was burned out. So she wasn't playing, she wasn't at her best, but that was the one win that all of a sudden Stan Smith and Arthur Ashe on the airplane ride home, I remember they came up to me and I used Stan Smith, Wilson racket.
Oh yeah.
And he goes, oh, I'm really happy that you're using my racket. And all these, you know, players, the pros kind of came up to me and I was like, oh, it was just something else. It was really a thrill for me.
All eyes on you at that point.
Start of my career, really.
Sure did. Yeah. It would be a minute before you'd settle into your iconic baseline game, but your results were about to make tennis history. So let's move on to topic 2. And I'd love to explore your early years on tour. We'd first see you playing full-time on tour in the early 1970s. How would you describe the tour in those early years?
Oh,
I mean, you're the youngest on tour, probably the youngest. Probably.
Well, you know, for the first few years, like 17, 18, 19, I pretty much traveled with my mom and the women, you know, Rosie. I mean, most of the pros were not really inviting to me. I mean, they weren't reaching out to me and saying, oh, you know, you're great for the tour. It was only Billie Jean that said, you know, stop treating her that way. She's great for the tour. She's going to put money in all of our pockets. So Billie Jean, because Billie Jean had vision, you know, and she knew that, okay, we still need young blood and we still need some new energy and we still need generations to come. So why don't we include Chrissy and really reach out to her and stop feeling that she's our competitor, because she's going to help bring in money. She's going to help bring in tournaments. And Billie Jean had a great, you know, again, you know, she could see the future for sure.
She's hot, yeah.
So for those 2 or 3 years when I was like 17, 18, 19, it was pretty isolated. Like it was my mom and I against, you know, the world, against the women, but all of the crowds were very supportive. And then finally, you know, when I was 19, I remember sitting my parents down and saying, I'd like to travel on my own. And that was a big step. And my parents said, great, you go right ahead.
Were you surprised by that? Were you shocked? Was just like, okay. I mean, you've been doing it, I guess, at that point.
Yeah, I thought maybe they would resist a little bit, but my mom still came to Grand Slams, but on the Virginia Slims tour, I pretty much went by myself. And then you develop friendships and then you travel with the girls or I would have my best friend at the time, Anna Laird, came with me to some of the tournaments. So my sister was at some of them, but mainly I traveled by myself and then became very close to all the players. And so what I remember about those years, the early to mid 70s, was that there's a lot of camaraderie because we were building the tour and we were the ones selling the tour. So everybody stuck together and everybody got along. And I just laugh when I tell the story about the French Open, when Martina and I played in the finals, the locker room had cleared out because it was the finals. And we looked at each other and it was like, Martina and I practiced before our final. And then we ate lunch together. And I remember we had roasted chicken and mashed potatoes. We ate lunch together. We played our final. We each went to press. And then we took a flight out of there together. So we did everything together. You know, we didn't have coaches. We didn't have enough money to have a team or have coaches or physios or anything like that. So we pretty much practiced. I remember Martina going, do you want me to serve anymore? And I go, yeah, I need to practice the out wide serve on the backhand side. And then I would say, do you need any more lobs? And she would go, yeah, I need a couple more lobs. And, you know, it was pretty funny.
That's hilarious. Oh, man. 1971 was a significant year for you because it was your run to the US Open semifinals in your very first US Open on the grass of the Westside Tennis Club that would catapult you onto tennis radars. That 1971 US Open was a big turning point in your popularity. And they were already putting you on big courts at 16 at that point. I mean, everyone wanted to come out and watch Chrissy. A huge fan of yours in Alexandria, Virginia, Marina Taylor, says, I'm your number one fan. I wondered, do you remember the moments where people started recognizing you outside of tennis?
Outside of tennis.
I mean, you're so young. You're on television. I mean, I'm thinking you're walking around.
Outside of tennis was after beating Margaret Court, you know, after being the number one player in the world. And, you know, I think that the funny thing is I got most popular in my high school. And, you know, it's like I didn't even know anybody.
That's not a shock to me. No, no one listening is shocked right now.
I got most likely to succeed.
Well, they got that right.
And most popular, but I wasn't even on the ballot for most athletic. What are you going to do? What does that tell you? Most popular. I walked with my head down. I was so shy. I was like, what is that? So obviously after I was 15 and then, you know, people started coming. I remember a Japanese promoter came knocking at my house and my dad answered the door and he had a suitcase and he brought the suitcase in and, he opened the suitcase and he had $25,000 in cash in the suitcase. And he said, you know, we'd like your daughter to come over and play an exhibition match. And my dad said, well, you can close your suitcase and just walk out the door. Thank you very much.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, that was before I turned pro, you know, so.
I mean, this is what we're unpacking today. This is what we want to hear. It's these stories that have, you know, made you who you are today. Well, it was the great Billie Jean King that proudly said, pressure is a privilege. And topic three today is how our cool Chris dealt with pressure on court. This topic piggybacks off of your amazing US Open run in 1971, and in particular, a nickname that legend Bud Collins is credited for inspiring before the British press ultimately dubbed you the Ice Maiden. Chris, a fan of yours, Curtis Dunn in San Francisco, California, he writes on Facebook and he says, I'd love to know what Chris really thought about being called the Ice Maiden. I think you had two nicknames. It was Ice Princess and Ice Maiden. And if you were listening, Curtis, she just sighed before I said that. So if that's any indication what she's about to say.
Well, you know, you're dubbed a name when you're very young and then you kind of feel like you have to play into it, you know, and I felt like Little Miss Icicle or whatever I was called, the Ice Maiden. I don't think the Brits meant it in a flattering way. I remember reading something like they printed, how could a young schoolgirl be so cold out on the court? And I was like, well, because I'm focusing.
Yeah.
You know, they just couldn't understand why I was out there giggling and kind of being immature and, you know, like a 16 or 17 year old girl would be. But I learned at a young age to control my emotions. I was an introvert anyway, so it really came pretty easy to me. And quite frankly, no point was important enough to be an ass out there, even to curse or argue with the linesman. It wasn't in my nature. It's a sport. It's a game. It's not life. You know, I just really sucked it up. you know? And I mean, as I got older, I could talk to the umpires and the linesmen and that, but at that age, especially, it was not in my DNA to really be controversial, to be argumentative. That's just the way I am. And so you're dubbed an image and then you feel like, God, I hope people don't feel like I'm this way off the court. Like I'm just a cold human being.
No, because I have to interrupt you because my favorite Chris Everett quote about you is from Rosie Casals. And she says, Chris is so funny off court, not so funny on court. So that tells you everything. You know what I mean? Like everyone knows off court, you're just fun. You're known to be a prankster. And then on court, you're so focused. You're so mentally tough and you get dubbed this. What's supposed to be a compliment, but you know, I understand why you take it that way.
I tell you one thing that is really, I think it is defining to me. And that is I was not the athlete, the natural gifted athlete that a Martina or a Manlikova or a Billie Jean or a Steffi, you know, or a Serena. I mean, I wasn't the naturally gifted physically. And so I compromised and I compensated by being present for every point. And I think that I started that at a very young age where every point I could be in the moment. And I don't think a lot of kids, even today, I have a tennis academy. I don't see the kids being in the moment, you know, because I knew that my opponent would make unforced errors, couldn't keep up their focus or their concentration through a whole match. And I would just look for those times and then just try to eat them alive.
Yeah. And you did. And you did 1300 times, I think, too. So, I mean, was there ever a moment where cool Chris almost turned into hot Chris? Did you ever feel it coming on? Is there one match in general that you just almost lost it?
Yeah. When I lost to Virginia Wade at Wimbledon, the semifinals, the year that she won it, I think it was 6-4 in the third. And I was like, that last game that I played, I almost half tanked it. It was like, okay, whatever. Cause the crowd was so, I mean, I didn't blame them. She's British, of course. She was their queen, but they were so loud and not applauding for me at all when I made, you know, I just felt, I was like having a little pity party out there for myself. And I was like, kind of half tried that last game. And so to me, that was my madness. I internalized it and I didn't perform well in the last game or two. I was so frustrated that I wish I could have that back and have been a little bit more mature.
That makes you so much more human right now. Everyone's listening. They're like, oh, thank goodness she's not perfect. Well, we're moving on to topic 4 and it touches upon the year 1973. And this year in particular was a big year that fans wanted to talk about, as it would not only be your first appearance in a Grand Slam final, but also the beginning of one of the most storied rivalries in sports history. Chris, you get to 2 Grand Slam finals that year at the French Open and Wimbledon, but who would guess that it would be a small tournament in Akron, Ohio that would overshadow 2 Grand Slam finals? All right, so I combed through your life, Chris, and I'm going to say right now, congratulations, because you're officially about to be asked for the 1 millionth time about Martina Navratilova. Yay! I'm going to insert a sound effect here, like popping confetti or something.
Dun, dun, dun.
I know you've talked about this rivalry 100 million times, probably.
That's okay. I never get tired of it. I never get tired of talking.
I understand why, because so many fans fell in love with both of you that way, because it was the camaraderie and the competitiveness. All right, I'm going to be in big trouble if I don't ask this question, because your fan in Tampa, Florida, my mother, wants to know, what's been your favorite memory with Martina away from tennis?
Going to Prague, Czechoslovakia, to play Federation Cup when Martina was an American citizen.
Yeah.
And
what a moment.
I just got to tell the story. I mean, I get a call from her and she's like, okay, I just want you to know I'm going to go play Fed Cup. I really want you and Pam to come and play also. And, but I just wanted to warn you that, you know, might not be safe. Like, thanks a lot. She goes, I don't know how they're going to accept me. I don't know what the danger is, but I'd like you to be part of the team. And I'm like, I'm there. Pam played also in Zena Garrison. So went over there and she was a no name. Okay. So the no name means there's no mention of her in newspapers. It was the USA team led by Chris Everett. You know, I was number 2, she was number 1, and they didn't mention her. And the first match, I'll never forget, they put me on center court, number 2 on the team, and they put Martina on the side court. But on the side court, people were climbing the fences and hanging on the fences, trying to watch her. And I'll never forget, there's a train that went alongside that backcourt and the train, there were people hanging out of the train, yelling her name and waving at her. So, I mean, it's like she had all the people. She was the people's princess, you know, but she didn't have, obviously, the government. So when our team was introduced, I remember she got a standing ovation. No, none of the players on the Czechoslovakian team got a standing ovation, but she did. And women, girls were crying. And Martina was crying. And we were all crying. And I looked at the corner of my eye up at the officials, the Czech officials, who were sitting on a balcony. And they were sitting there not clapping. They're just sitting there, you know, not reacting at all. So anyway, we played our matches. And ironically, we played Czechoslovakia in the final. And the crowds were 100% behind her. She played Hanna Manlikova. And we won. And when they present us with the cup, all the fans, again, standing ovation. And I looked out of the corner of my eye and the officials were standing up and applauding. The communist regime was standing up and clapping for Martina. So you asked me my favorite memory. I just think that transcends tennis. That gets into the human spirit. That gets into politics. That gets into other areas that are so deep, like you said, deep layers. And that, to me, was very impactful in my life. And I always tell her that. I always tell her when I see her that.
Yeah. I love that. See, Mom, are you listening? Because we were talking about it yesterday and I said, she's going to say that moment in the Czech Republic. I mean, this is a powerful moment. Mom said, we're together when she met Andy Mill. I mean, isn't that going to be number one? Wouldn't that be the best one? Didn't she have kids because of this interaction? I was like, Mom, she's going to say Martina. I just, it's a very important moment in tennis history.
Yeah. That's another juicy story. But anyway,
the wine conversation.
Hey everyone, I really hope you're enjoying this week's episode. I always have to pinch myself with these legendary tennis greats. It's amazing. And speaking of great, I almost forgot to mention that our friends at goldenageoftennis.com are running the greatest sale that I've ever seen on their website. After this episode, log on to www.goldenageoftennis.com. Enter the promo code FANTASTIC for 10% off and pick out your favorite iconic relaunch clothing design so you can start your 2022 tennis season off in style. Now let's jump back into the second half of today's show.
All right, we're on to topic five, but the magic number here is actually 18, not five. Let's talk about your Grand Slam titles, Chris Everett. You'd win your first Grand Slam, befittingly, at the French Open in 1974, followed by Wimbledon. And this is where anyone that had put their money on you being the next superstar of tennis was smiling to the bank because you're now the best player in the world and the face of the tour. Do you remember that moment in Paris? Obviously, I'm sure you do. I mean, so many titles, but did it seem like your dreams were coming true at that moment?
You know, it was the year before in 73, I really should have won the French Open because I think I was up 5-3 in the third against Margaret Court. And I lost, I don't know how I lost that match, but somehow I wasn't ready, you know, mentally. I didn't close the match. So the next year, 74, you know, I really wasn't the kind of person that really celebrated. I kind of was like, oh, I'm really happy. I went to call my dad. I went to talk to my family. But then it's on to the next week.
Yeah, I know.
So I mean, I really...
Life of a tennis player.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I had longevity in my career. But at the same time, I kind of wondered, maybe I should have enjoyed my wins a little bit more. But I was very lucky to win Wimbledon that year. I should never have won Wimbledon that year. I was not the best grass court player in the world. I was really lucky because I have to get this right. Carrie Reed beat Billy? Oh, no, or was it...
She Melville at the time? Is she...
Carrie Melville beat either Yvonne or Billie Jean, and Olga Morozova beat the other one. Yeah. Okay, so I beat Carrie Reed and I beat Olga Morozova, but definitely Billie Jean was a better grass court player than me. And definitely Yvonne Gulagong was a better grass court player than me at the time. So, I mean, you know, when you look back, you see titles you should have won and didn't. And then you see titles you shouldn't have won and did. And this is one that I was like, oh yeah, right? I'm number one in the world in grass? I don't think so. So I was kind of lucky to win that one, but I'll take it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you took a whole bunch more. You had some magical moments in finals. In particular, your 1984 and 85 US Open finals against Martina, both the highest of caliber you're going to find. Chris, one of your biggest fans who sends so much respect and love to you, by the way, Scott Huddleston in Austin, Texas. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Scott.
So everyone knows he connected us today. So I'm very grateful. Power of fans. I love fan culture. Yeah. He writes in and asks, Why so reluctant to change from wood to graphite rackets? Your results against Martina immediately improved, giving us two of the greatest US Open finals in 1984 and 85. Looking back, do you regret not making the change earlier?
Wow, good observation, Scott. He's right. I was probably the last pro to go to graphite. Hey, you know what? I was a baseliner, okay? I was conservative. I played it safe, and I played it safe with rackets also. And I guess I was fearful that I would lose the control and the consistency in that. But I had been trying them in practice, but the balls were flying all over. They were flying. Okay, I lost my consistency. I got a little power, a little more power. But then Wilson made one that was as close to wood as you can get. And, you know, that was the pro staff, Wilson pro staff. And so I felt very comfortable with that.
Yeah. And there was history. There we go, Scott.
Yeah.
Well, we're going on to topic six. And this one's just a question. On November 3rd, 1975, the very confusing WTA computer rankings were introduced, but there was no confusion as to who should be crowned number one officially for the very first time. You trade being number one with Martina 9 times for a total of 260 weeks at number one. But the majority of your fans ignore that stat because you'd already won 2 Grand Slams in 1974. So everyone's rolling their eyes right now who's listening because, you know, you would have had so many more weeks. But anyway, that's just another story. But I did want to mention a show which I loved, Chris Evert One-on-One, which you can find on YouTube. And it's you interviewing all former WTA number ones like Martina and Vika and Lindsay and Justine, so many greats. I wondered what you took away from those interviews, Chris. Obviously, as a storied number one in history, getting those moments was really great to hear.
Whoa, that's an interesting question. I think that the common denominators, the common characteristics that all of these pros had was that they had that belief in themselves and they were tenacious and they went after it. And they were not afraid. There was no fear there whatsoever. And that's kind of like a couple generations past mine. You know, I mean, I always had a little fear when I played. You know, I wasn't full of confidence, but that worked for me. But these players that I interviewed, the number ones, they made it happen. Yeah, they had the determination, they had, you know, the discipline, but you need a little more than that. And you need to have the ability to finish a match, to deal with pressure well, and to make good results and make it happen. And they had that extra level, very much like a Djokovic has now or a Nadal. They had that belief, you know, in themselves.
Anyone who hasn't listened, go YouTube, all of them. They're all amazing to listen to.
Yeah.
Can we expect maybe ATP number ones next year? We'd love to see this again. We have to think about this maybe. I don't know.
Oh, ATP. You know, what was really neat was I knew most of the women on a personal level. You know, I knew them. And I, from working with ESPN and from being at the tournaments, you know, I know their coaches. And so they felt comfortable with me, you know, so I thought it was a very enlightening.
Topic number seven is a fun one. I'd like to dive into the impact you had onto popular culture. There was a time in the 70s and 80s where everyone was trying to emulate not only your strokes, but also your style. We talk about fashion for a moment. Before Serena's catsuit and Anne White's leotard, there was Chris Everett's lace and Ted Tingling dress. And of course, we've all heard the rumors about the diamond tennis bracelet. Everyone wanted to dress like you, Chris, for sure. And there was a lot of questions about your fashion. Kelly Dowd in Saratoga Springs, New York asks, what was your favorite outfit you wore during your career?
Oh, okay. Probably when you mentioned lace, I had an all lace dress when I played Billie Jean at the US Open when I was 16.
So famous.
And when I see that picture, I'm like, a lot of work went into that dress. Mondessa Swift, I remember from Fort Lauderdale, made that dress for me. And it was beautiful. It was all lace. It was just gorgeous. I think that I brought sundresses, halter tops, cutouts. You know, I brought all that into the game.
Color, print, everything.
Yeah. You know, colors and, you know, ruffle bloomers and, you know, ribbons and, you know, jewelry. And the tennis bracelet, of course, was interesting, you know, dropping that on the court. And then all of a sudden there's worldwide attention on that.
Yeah.
But I always wanted still to have some femininity, you know, as much as you want to be obviously you want to be athletic. You really want to be a warrior out there and grinding it out, and you're sweating. But at the same time, you know, I wanted to be feminine and look good too. And I think, you know, it just made me feel better about myself that way.
Well, as a tennis icon who ended up on a box of Wheaties, do you still have that box of Wheaties, by the way?
I do.
Okay, good.
To my office. Yeah.
Fans were always trying to get your attention. What was the strangest fan interaction you remember besides today? What was the...
I've had some ones that weren't so good. So, yeah. I mean, I had at Wimbledon, I had a guy living in my closet. I was getting some housework done and the door was, I guess, open, and a guy slipped in and he was living in my closet and smoking cigarettes. And like 3 or 4 days later, somebody found him and he went to jail. And then, you know, you get disturbing mail and...
Wow. A lot of creepy gifts, I'm sure, too. I'm sure a lot of things.
Oh, my gosh. I've gotten death threats just like any other top athlete, or not any other, but anybody who's been in the public eye comes with the territory. It really does. And you really have to be careful. But the fans in general were always great. I can't really think of one particular fan, but there's a couple that I still keep in touch with, which is nice.
With being one of the most recognizable people in the world, was there something that you were offered that you turned down? I'm guessing you turned down Dancing with the Stars like 6 times at this point, at least.
I turned down Dancing with the Stars whenever I'm asked, because I'm not a good dancer. I am like, I would be out first round, you know, and also tennis players are kind of notorious. I think Martina and I think Monica and I think Martina Hingis, maybe? No. It was Monica, Martina... Was there anybody else?
I think Radwanska did it in her country, but she won, I think.
Oh,
she got to the finals. So she broke the spell, at least.
Yeah, she's got the rhythm. Right. But the other two, yeah. But courage. I mean, a lot of courage. There have been endorsements I've turned down if I don't believe in them, or if I don't use them, or if it's like, well, I don't use this stuff. But even if you're getting paid a lot of money, it's just not genuine.
I'm sure people were trying to get you in movies in the 70s and 80s too. I'm sure there was tons of stuff. If we go through and comb through, I'm sure there was tons of things you were like, yeah, anyway.
Okay.
Come on, right. You're famous.
Keep thinking that.
Topic 8 is about your rivals on court. You had so many great matchups during your career, from Billie Jean King to Monica Seles. You played so many amazing legends. Can we play word association for one moment? You had so many fans ask specifically your thoughts about these tennis legends. So when I say their name, can you tell me the first word that comes to mind?
Yeah, except if it's Billie Jean, I'll tell a little story.
How about, let's start with Tracy Austin. First word.
Pigtails.
Pigtails.
Braces. Pigtails and braces.
Oh, I love it. Hannah Menlikova.
Oh, boy. Talented.
Steffi Graf.
Strong.
Yeah. Pam Shriver.
Funny.
Martina Navratilova.
Rival.
And then we'll finish with Billie Jean. What's your story?
Billie Jean. Okay, so Billie Jean has always been like a mentor to me. And she has always given me, she is the wisest person I know. And she's always given me a lot of advice. And in the beginning, I remember when when Jimmy and I were breaking up our engagement, we were so young, and she's going, Chrissy, she goes, this is the right thing. You have to grow up and you have to really know yourself well before you're in a relationship. So she gave me always advice about my relationships. She gave me advice about my tennis. When we played doubles together, she'd yell at me to get into the net. Get into the net! Say, and she'd look back at me and I'd be fearful. She told me that when she was president of the WTA, that I had to be vice president so that the next year I could be president of the WTA because we needed leadership. So she did that. And she even gave me advice. This is the funniest thing. She even gave me advice on how to raise kids, and she's never had kids. How are the kids? Well, actually, one of my sons, da 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 da. Well, he should dip me. Blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, she always gave me advice. And I go, you don't even have kids. What are you talking about? You don't even have kids. So anyway, she's great. Fun.
Oh, man. We're winding down today. You played almost 1,500 matches during your career, Chris. So I know I'm going to disappoint a lot of fans by not covering a lot of these iconic matches. So let's try and cover a couple of them really quick. Topic 9 is Chris's favorite matches. I'll read a category. You tell me which match best fits your memory in this category. What was your best comeback match, Chris?
Nancy Ritchie, down 6-love, 5-1, 40-15. Wait, 6-1, 5-love, or 6-love, 5-1, whatever it was. And tied for U.S. Open, because that's kind of where the pressure is. Marion Isel down 6 match points. Yeah.
Everyone is freaking out about your 88 Wimbledon Laura Galarza quarterfinal.
Oh, that was a good one too. Yeah.
They were sweating that match. It was like crazy.
Point for 5-1 for Laura, and I hit a down the line backhand passing shot.
Ripper.
So lucky to get out of that one too.
The most gratifying win of your career.
85 French Open against Martina.
The best match you think you ever played?
I think I beat Steffi Graf's. I beat Steffi like 11-1 one time. And Peter Graf came up to me and said, "That's the best woman's tennis that I've ever seen." And he was like giving me a compliment. So, and that was in Miami. I think I beat her 11-1. And then I beat Martina 11-11.
You sure did.
We always laugh about that. I go, "Really, Martina, you couldn't have gotten a game from me?"
All right, last one in this round. The loss that hurt the most.
Well, US Open, when I played Martina, 86, three sets. And I just was disappointed in myself because I didn't go for it. It was like 4-all or 3-all or 4-all in the third. And I got tentative and I chickened out and didn't hit the ball and I lost. Yep.
Topic 10 is your last couple years on tour. Let's talk about your farewell tour. In 1998, you started the year by making the last Grand Slam final of your career in Australia, which was also your 34th Grand Slam final. And you beat Martina in the semifinals playing some amazing tennis before you'd run into a very determined Steffi Graf in her Golden Slam season. By 1989, you'd play 10 tournaments, with your last event being the 1989 US Open. But you'd go out in style, winning the last five matches of your career, winning the Fed Cup as a goodbye to tennis.
Yep.
Chris, you had a very long and successful career. Did you go back and forth with that decision, or was that 100% you were wanting new adventures at that point? You were done.
I was burned out mentally. I was fine physically. I was burned out mentally. I went the year before in 88, I was like having days when I didn't want to get out of bed and I didn't want to have to face playing matches and in front of millions of people on TV. And that's when I knew. And I remember Andy Mill at that time, I was with him. I don't know if we were married then, but he said he was an Olympic skier and he had 12 operations and he was kind of forced out of his career by physical ailments and surgeries. And he said to me, he goes, "Milk it as long as you can, because once you leave the game, you'll never come back." It gave me incentive to play another year. And so I'm glad I did.
Oh, great story. Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. Do you remember that last? I mean, obviously you remember the last match against Zina. I mean, she was crying. Everyone was crying. The entire crowd was crying. And I mean, did it take a minute for you to kind of realize, okay, that was it? Or,
you know what? In all my matches, it didn't hit me until I reached the locker room and I was like taking a shower. You know, I don't know if I just had that ability to hold on to it, to that peace of mind until I left the court or what, but I was kind of in a daze, you know. But I'm so glad I lost that way because I was up 4-1 and then I didn't finish the match and I really had a winning record over Zina. But that was one of the reasons why I stopped playing, because I just didn't have that focus every single point. And I was mentally burned out. I mean, I started playing tournaments when I was like 8 years old.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. I think that's,
it was going to happen.
I mean, it kind of just solidified what your feelings were. So yeah, I get it.
Yes. So my retirement wasn't like, "Oh, I'm so upset." You know, it was more like, you know, I had Andy, we lived in Aspen, we wanted to have kids. We got excited about living another life.
We've talked so much about your great matches today, but for this next topic, your fans wanted to highlight your work on ESPN. You work with the absolute best crew, Mary Jo, Chris McHenry, yep. Pam, Renee.
We have a great team and Jamie Reynolds heads, he's our boss and he's really a great people person. He kind of balances all of our personalities and our egos at the same time. It's a real eclectic group though, as you said, you know, from Brad Gilbert to John McEnroe to Pam Shriver to me. I mean, there's just a lot of different, very strong opinions and
personalities.
Very strong people.
So many personalities on
yeah,
that.
I mean, but we all get along. You know, there's no friction with anybody. Everybody kind of knows that we're now it's about teamwork. It's not about individual needs or wants. It's about teamwork. And so we go along with the team. It's been fun.
Favorite match you've commentated? I know that's kind of a silly question. There's so many that run through your head. Anything that pops up real quick of a match that you just said, "Wow, that was just, you know, something I'm not going to forget."
Oh boy. No.
Yeah. No, it's honest. There you go. You're being honest today. This is it.
No, I know I've done a lot of exciting matches and, you know, I have so much respect for this generation of professionals because I see the work both on and off the court that they have to do. And it's just three times as much as we did it in the, you know, 70s and 80s. But there's really not one match that I can think of off the top of my head.
You've stayed so active in the sports. Plus, I have to mention, the Chris Everett celebrity pro-ams have raised over $26 million for charity over the years. I mean, that is remarkable. It really, really is. Is there anything left on the bucket list for you, Chris Everett? What's left?
Well, by the way, that charity goes, the recipients, it's drug abuse, it's prevention of drug abuse. And it's for all the drug abuse centers down here, the programs down here in South Florida. I think that right now it's really about staying healthy, really, and staying mentally healthy, physically healthy, and remaining really close to my kids. I'm the chairperson of the USCA Foundation, which targets underserviced kids who, you know, don't have the money to play tennis and don't have those resources. And it's all about tennis and education. And I love spearheading that. My pro celebrity, again, is charitable things. I mean, it's about giving now because I lived such a great life.
Amazing life, for sure.
I didn't mention my tennis academy, which I have to mention, because to me, that's about mentoring and coaching kids during their life. And it's not only about, you know, the forehand grip, but it's about mentoring. And I'm really enjoying that with my brother, John.
What's the last time you played tennis? Do you get to play?
About an hour ago.
Oh, really?
Okay. No, I hit with the kids. Yeah, I hit with the kids in the morning and they don't like my underslice forehand or my drop shots or my lobs.
I'm sure just like you said that to Francois Durr too, when you played her, yeah. You know, you're like, hey, what are you playing like? That's not how we play.
Exactly.
That is absolutely not true, Chrissy. They love you at the academy.
Oh, who is on the line? Is this Victoria Azarenka joining us right now?
Hi. Hi. How's it going?
Oh my goodness.
How's your vacation, girl?
It's going well. I'm just about to go on the slopes again, but I'm going to the gym first.
Yeah, just so everyone listening, Victoria Azarenka has just joined the call today to say hi to Chris Everett. This is crazy. I'm in a legend sandwich right now.
Vika moved down to Boca where we live, and she's so great. And she trains with her coach and she trains at the academy, and the kids love having her. And we've gotten to know each other a little bit and, you know, trying to get her set for 2022. Show
right.
her stuff.
That's right. Oh my gosh. Hi, V.
Exactly.
Hey, V, I want to ask you, what is it about Chris? I know you have so much respect for her and we've talked about her so many times and, you know, just how amazing Chris is. What has she meant to you during your career?
Oh God.
Well, I will have to say this. I didn't really know Chrissy personally until like I moved to Florida to train there. I've always known who Chrissy is, and I've always admired her, you know, tenacity and her touch and the way she carried herself throughout her career. It was always very amazing to watch. And I think the evolution of her game was really exciting. We talked so much after I really got to know her, you know, more personally. She shared with me the things that I think at a certain time when you are very, very successful in your career and you face with a dilemma how to get better, because something has worked so well for you, but it maybe doesn't work as well anymore against certain players. And I remember talking to her about losing to Martina many times in a row, and then she adjusted her game. And I thought that this was one of the coolest things to learn from legends like Chrissy, that all the achievements that she had, she was always looking for improvement, and she wouldn't stop until she figured it out. So I thought that was really awesome. It's one of my favorite moments of our conversation.
Wow. I mean, today is amazing. I think the impact that you've had, Chris, is, you know, it's generational for sure. I mean, I'm good friends with V and, you know, I just...
Yeah. I actually have to say, Chrissy, about John. When I met him, he's the biggest women's tennis fan, like literally one of the biggest. To know the strength of interest and love for women's games was amazing. He didn't know any men's players. He doesn't really know many.
Don't blow my cover. Maybe don't tell people that. Don't say that.
I think because of the podcast, you've learned and you research, and I know how much you love to research about people, but that was really awesome. And John, I don't want to jump in your podcast, but I do have a question for Chrissy, and I think it would be cool for listeners to hear.
Yes, this should be a show in itself. Are you kidding me? I should just log off right now. This is what people want. Go ahead.
So one of the conversations me and Chrissy had, it was at the fish restaurant. I don't remember the name, in Boca. And Chrissy was talking about, not about regretting something in her career. She said, I wish I was a bit more vocal when I was at the prime of my career. Is that something you remember, Chrissy?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I just wanted to kind of understand, what would you want to be more vocal about at that time in the game, at that time and at that space in women's game?
I think what I meant was, I think that being in the public eye, I think it can scare you away from being controversial or to voicing your opinions because you're afraid of, or you're fearful of criticism. And I was always like a people pleaser. And I just wish that I had stronger convictions, and B, the convictions I had, like equality. And there's just so many, I think, human issues that have come up in the last 30 or 40 years that I wish I would have spoken out about women's rights mainly, and, you know, supporting women and, you know, talking about health and mental health and talking about physical health. And I don't know, Vika, it's just, I had that personality that, you know, I was, I think, a little bit more of a follower in the beginning than a leader. And I just wish I would have led, you know, a little bit more.
I think that all comes, you know, from experience, because if I look at my own career and things that I wish I would have maybe said or done when I was 21, you're like, yeah, that could have. But I think you wouldn't learn without kind of going through things that we've gone through. And I think one of the interesting points from, you know, your generation compared to my generation is that I feel like from my parents, it's always been like, okay, you need to put your head down, work hard and not say anything and just go for it. Like, there's no complaining, there's no pain, no gain, which is one of the things that everybody continues to use, which I kind of hate. But it just feels like it was that mentality, you know, always just, you know, shut up and do it. And you have to be okay with that. Yeah. And I feel like it's very changing now, right? That, you know, we have a generation of, not even my generation like younger than mine, saying, no, you know what, there's different things. And I think that gap between kind of your generation, my generation, and new generation, there's a misunderstanding because it's such a different upbringing, different approach. Yeah. And I feel that really strongly now.
You're right. I mean, even in my generation, before your generation, it was children should be seen and not heard. And it was like, you know, you don't air your dirty laundry out in public. And, you know, you didn't do it. You know, you didn't talk unless you had something nice to say. I mean, I remember my mom saying, don't say anything unless you have something nice to say. And so it's fear. It's fear of what people will think of you. It's self-consciousness. And you're right, Vika. Now, I have to hand it to Richard Williams, by the way, because I think he was one of the first fathers or tennis parents that said to his kids, Serena and Venus, go for it. Don't be, you know, be fearless. Don't be fearful. Go for it. I don't care what happens. You know, just don't be fearful. And I'm like, God, you know, if we would have been taught like that, you know, we might have been different people. We might have had different careers. Who knows? But it's just, it's more belief in yourself right now, Vika, than it ever has been. By the way, Vika, I have to say one thing. Vika's a great cook too, by the way. That's another talent she has. Okay. All right. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I absolutely, thank you for that. But I absolutely agree with that. But one thing that I think that is much more on alert and much more, you know, kind of lays heavy on the, I think, younger generation, on myself partly as well too, is that the image that you kind of put out there, because everything is kind of under a microscope, and you don't, especially if you're in a public eye, you basically have no place to hide. And I think when you were playing, when you were in your, you know, prime, which was for a very long time, do you feel like that would have been something that would be much harder to handle, or that's something that you would feel like would have helped you maybe to be more open? By the way, John, I'm just doing all your job right now.
I love it. I love this right now. Are you kidding me? I told you I'm muting this microphone. This is way more entertaining. This is now a show for me.
No, that's a good question. I think that it helped my tennis, that I was under the radar, that I wasn't controversial, that I was quieter. It was under, you know, I think it helped my tennis because I didn't need any distractions, you know, and I was pretty much like a tennis machine where, I don't know, I just, that was my life. That was my life, really. Thank God we had Billie Jean, because she did all the talking for everybody. Didn't have to do much talking after they got a hold of her.
Yeah. Well, she's still pushing the needle for all of us. And I think that's one of the things that I absolutely admire about legends like you, like Billie Jean King, is that inspiration of kind of pushing tennis forward from where I started to I'm going to stop. I think that's for me, that's definitely one of the main goals I want to achieve is, you know, winning and tournaments. Obviously, it's an immediate goal, but I think the longer term is that leave that impact and hope the young is going to follow. So I want to thank you for inspiring me to be able to kind of go in your footsteps and follow. So I would say that you are definitely a leader in our sport, and I really appreciate you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to hop out. I'll let you continue.
Thank you so much. Everyone, that's Victoria Azarenka.
Thank you, Vika. That was very
this
sweet.
Is amazing. Amazing today.
One strong woman. That's for sure.
Love you, girl. Talk to you later. Oh, man.
She's probably a great skier, too. She does everything well.
We're wrapping up today. There's just two more questions and we'll wrap up, Chris. Thank you so much for your time. You have a huge fan of yours, Elias De Vries in London, UK. He wanted to ask if you were aware of how huge of a gay fan base you had during your career. I don't know if you were aware of the influence, because it's not like you were seeking the approval of the community at any point, but the influence you had was huge.
Well, I have two answers for that. First of all, no, because I thought Martina had all the gay fans. You know, I mean, whenever we played at tournaments, it was so funny, especially when we started playing tournaments, we started playing each other. I had more people rooting for me because, you know, I don't think back 30, 40 years ago, being gay was as accepted or even embraced. I don't even want to use the word accepted, embraced as it is now. And people weren't quite sure, you know, they're kind of going through that. Oh, this is something new. How should we feel about it? But her fans were really vocal, you know? So I only saw like, you know, gay women, gay guys, you know, going up to her after a match and you know, because she was there, you know, she was their idol.
It was the beacon. Yeah. I mean, for sure.
But then as my career went on, got a lot of letters from especially gay men who just loved me and loved my career. And I'm like, you got good. Great.
There you go, Elias. She's aware now. Not at the time, but now she is. So that's good.
Yeah, they can relate to me on a certain level. They can relate to me or the way I behave for some reason. And, you know, I love it.
It's everything. It's the, you know, come on, you're Chris Everett. It was easy to love, to gravitate towards you. So,
no, well, thank you. Gravitate.
We are wrapping up today with the legend, Chris Everett. Obviously, we haven't spoken about maybe an eighth of what your career has been. I mean, 34 Grand Slam singles finals, 125 match clay court win streak.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt here because I'm going to say what Vika meant about when you're in your career and you have to change something at a late, because you're so, champions are stubborn. They want to stick with what they know. And what she was referring to was 13 times in a row losing to Martina Navratilova and playing the same style, just trying to win from the baseline. And Dennis Ralston was my coach at that time. And he would tell me, Chrissy, you've got to come into the net. You've got to take the net away from her. And I'm like, no. I would hear it, but I wouldn't do it because I was stubborn. It took me 13 times. And then that 14th time, I was so frustrated. It was like, okay, you just got to try it. You know, don't be so stubborn. And so I went in a couple times on her backhand side and realized that she didn't pass me. Or she would miss a pass. And I was like, wow. And then I did it. And then that was in Key Biscayne in Miami. And then I played her at the French Open in 85 and I beat her. And then I beat her in 86. And I realized that I had to make a few major changes in my game. And that was one of the things, because it's a mindset to be aggressive and to go into the net. And so that was pivotal. And that's what Vika was referring to. So I said, let that be a lesson to everybody who's listening in your life, even in the way your attitude is, or you keep going for the wrong person, you know, whatever it is in life, you change a losing game, then you stick with a winning game.
No one beats Chris Everett 14 times in a row. It's not happening. It doesn't happen. It's never happened. I mean, come on. Oh, man. Obviously, I was going through your list of accolades. Your resume is, come on, impossibly long. Is there one record that you look back and say, okay, that's one that I can just say, okay, yeah, that was pretty cool?
90 percentile win-loss record.
Out of any male or female?
I don't know. I think that might stay for a while.
It's mind-numbing. It's crazy to think that. Chris, I thank you so much for joining today. It was very special. Aww. So I thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Good questions. You really, like Vika said, you did a lot of research. It was really good. Thank you. You've been great. You're great.
What a fun show. A special thank you to my friend Vika Azarenka for popping in today to say hi. Begah, I can't wait for your episode. It's going to be so much fun. Our guest today is extremely active on Twitter. You can follow her at Chrissy Everett, as well as the same handle on Instagram. And while you're on Instagram, shoot me a DM at John Garica and let me know who you're a big fan of and who you'd like to see on an upcoming show. Also, don't forget to follow us at Fantastic Tennis Pod or on Twitter at FanTennisPod. My name is John Garica, and thank you for listening. This has been Fantastic.